This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Dr. Lyle, we are now in fall solstice. How you been doing?
Well, very good. I didn't realize that. Thank you. Doing well, mate. How you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, with the changing of the weathers, I'm always interested to see if human behavior changes. Just like last time we talked about human mating seasons, and just always curious how I always imagine that in a Stone Age, the humans around this time are starting to like collect a lot of food for the winter and all this other stuff. But given what you said last time, that most of our history was in the desert or was in the Sahara, sub-Saharan Africa, there goes that idea.
Yes, in fact, I don't think there's any doubt that the change of seasons will bring towards the fall and winter, will bring a low-grade anxiety to the system, as there's the possibility of famine. And as a result, that's why fall has that little maudlin feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's...
Very much so.
Yeah, let me check the audio with you because it seems like you're a little further away.
Okay, hold on.
Much
right
better.
Right on top of my microphone, okay?
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
Fantastic. Yeah, so does this explain why we have the fall holidays and the winter holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas, et cetera, et cetera?
No.
Okay. Completely wrong.
Those are totally modern things. That's nothing to do with natural history.
All right. Well, today our topic is going to be stress management and how to manage stress in a variety of different ways. Before we get to that, we had a couple of listeners that emailed me. And again, listeners are more than welcome to email me and we go over their questions before we get to the topic. So a couple of questions. This has to do with a listener who's a talented musician.
Mm-hmm.
So he's asking, Dr. Lyle, I'm a talented musician according to most. I've gone through several different financial situations in life, and for a decade I was making a very solid six-figure income. And as a result, mm-hmm. I attracted and dated tons of attractive, very attractive, high-value women. More recently, mm-hmm. though, I left the corporate rat race and focused on other areas of my life, namely music. But in doing so, mm-hmm. I've taken a huge pay cut. And I realized my success with women went out the window when I stopped making good money. Now, I'm good-looking, agreeable, socially adept, and so forth. But I understand now that because of evolutionary drives, women might be largely attracted to material wealth, especially after their 20s. Question. Are music and art careers essentially a poor evolutionary strategy for men of limited means? The more I reflect on this, the more I believe this is the case. Of course, there's a tiny fraction of famous artists who can attract high-value women, but I'd argue much of that is due to their commercial and financial success, whereas financial success in the arts is like a casino. There's no guarantees of being successful regardless of talent. When I look around, I notice that most boring, average guys with good careers have functioning families and somewhat fulfilling lives on the outside. Few artists I know have very stable long-term relationships, and I notice this even among famous artists. Almost none have children. I'd be extremely interested to hear your insights into this topic, Dr. Lyle.
A lot of good thinking there. The last few things he's thinking are just sort of his own eyeball observations and won't stand to scrutiny, but that's neither here nor there. The truth is that this listener is thinking very, very clearly. Obviously, he's experienced this process. The let's sort of break this down as to why this works this way. The what the arts are and athletics are, these are what we're going to call fitness indicators. And so fitness indicators are sexually attractive features of an organism that that the opposite sex uses as yardsticks to measure one member against the other. So think about women's breasts and their hips and their lips and the arch of their eyebrows, et cetera. Think about men's chests, their torsos. Think about men's athleticism, how high they can jump, et cetera. Think about people's hair and how freakish it is to people to lose their hair, because hair is a sexual ornament or a fitness indicator. So this is so it turns out that there are fitness indicators that are also purely neural circuits. So it's going to turn out that you know, how you sing, how you dance, whether you know what skills you have inside your head, whether you can do chess or math problems, et cetera. These are also fitness indicators, and so the what I and they are particularly things like the arts. These are fitness indicators, or what you might call ornaments. They're like a little thing that dresses up the Christmas tree to make it particularly attractive. And the fitness indicators or ornaments make terrible careers. And let me explain why they make terrible careers. It isn't that they might not make a fabulous career. In fact, in principle, they could make the most incredible, fabulous careers that you would ever see. But let's talk about why they make, in general, very lousy careers. The reason is because a fitness indicator, let's suppose you're a singer, okay? So singing winds up being a fitness indicator for the reason that the human voice is a mechanism to detect the degree of masculinity or femininity in the person on the other side of that voice. So it turns out that voices are sexually attractive to varying degrees. Some people have terrible voices. Some people have great voices. And that winds up being a fitness indicator, probably because it winds up being, the voice itself winds up being quite a good mechanism for detecting, or a variable for detecting testosterone and estrogen levels. So a highly estrogenized female has a very soft, beautiful, high voice, and a very testosterone-ized male has a deep, resonant voice. And so, and those are sexually attractive. So people with extraordinary voices are, this is enhancing their sex appeal fairly substantially. And so much so that you can make a career out of it. And if it turns out that, you know, in the old days, you didn't have to be very attractive because they didn't have television. So you could just be a tremendous voice. These days, you better have it all. You better be great looking and have a great voice, or you're going to be out of luck in all probability. So the but in any event, the display of sexual ornaments is the most direct mechanism by which to impact the opposite sex and increase your market share, and therefore to get the very best deal that you could possibly get. This is why girls would love to be models and actresses. Boy, would that be fancy. In other words, if I was so beautiful that I could be a model, what could be better than making money while I'm displaying my fitness indicators, for God's sakes? What could be better for a young man than to be a professional athlete, for goodness sakes? Nothing. Unless you're going to be a rock star, that's even better. So if you could sing or dance or do athletics, these would be – it's almost incredible, if you think about it, that what would have been a glimpse and a part-time process in the Stone Age, after you'd gone to all the trouble of feeding the kids, making sure the predators don't get you or your kids, making sure you get fed, etc., then you go out there and try to secure a better mate or trade up or just get a mate by displaying your fitness indicators at the little local dance or whatever the heck the thing is. So a little spear throwing contest that happens, you know, once a week. So instead, people in the modern environment look at this and they say, well, you know, I feel like I should follow my dream. You know, my dream is to be an actress. Well, fine. The bottom line is that you and everybody else has that same idea, because in principle, nothing could be as genetically efficient as spending the core of your time on Earth displaying your extraordinary fitness indicators. Okay, if you could do such a thing, it would be an incredible thing to do, because it would be such an unbelievably efficient, smart thing to do. Everybody with any talent wants to do it. And as a result, there's a tremendous supply of gorgeous females out there that will all like to be models. And guess what? Almost none of them get to be. And of those that get to be, most of them make about $13,000 a year trying to do this full time. And then there's a few, as the man said, it's like a casino. There's a few that happen to hit a niche and happen to get lucky and just have, you know, one less mutation than the next person, at least when it comes to their face. And it winds up that they wind up making, you know, $1 million a year. Same thing with athletics. I'll tell a story. I was working in the probation department at Dallas in the 1990s, and I had a guy come in. He was on probation, and I don't know what he did. So I remember he beat somebody up, and he was a big guy. This guy walked in the door, and he was about 6'2" and about 250 pounds. He was just big and strong and unbelievable athletics looking. And I asked him, I said, hey, well, did you play sports? Yeah. I said, do you play football? He says, yes, I did. I said, where'd you play? He says, well, I played in the USFL, okay, which was a pro football league that competed with the NFL for a period of time. And pretty fancy. And he had had NFL tryouts. This guy had, I said, where'd you go to college? He said, Oklahoma State. And I said, Oklahoma State. He said, "Where? Who is in the backfield there with you? Did you play much?" He says, "No, I didn't play at all." He said, "How is that?" Well, in front of him, in the backfield at Oklahoma State, were two running backs by the name of Thurman Thomas and Barry Sanders, who are both in the Hall of Fame, I understand. Okay? Mm. This guy couldn't get off the bench at Oklahoma State, but he almost made the NFL because he was the number three running back on the depth chart at Oklahoma State. That guy is one mutation away from being a $50 million guy. Okay? Instead, he was a thug in Dallas, you know, holding up liquor stores or whatever the hell he was doing. Okay? So the bottom line is that fitness indicators or sexual ornaments make terrible careers, and so this man's trajectory here makes complete sense. It sounds like he was very bright, very competent, made a really good living in the corporate world, which is where we all dig and trudge and do the best we can to try to be as efficient as possible at giving people what they want so that we can spend more time doing what we want. That's what making a living is. And then when he tried to make his fitness indicator into a career, it turned out he took a big dive. And of course, females are looking for provisioning. And it's going to be a very important thing for women to look for provisioning, because they're going to be trying to see how on earth they're going to get the bills paid and to have a nice $50,000 SUV to protect the children that they're going to have. And so suddenly a musician knocking down $18,000 a year and getting that done. So absolutely all correct. And however, I would also comment about something else that he said. He said that it seems that the musicians that he's seen and artists don't have stable relationships. That's because they are inherently adventurous people. That artists are, in almost by definition, very open to experience. And as a result, they are going to have a strong tendency to be open to sexual experience, which means they're not going to make very good pair bondage generally. And as a result, that's an additional reason why you're going to find so much instability in those arenas. That isn't to say that everybody that's highly artistic has that bent, but there is certainly a very significant correlation between the artistic personality and low fidelity.
Yeah, it's interesting. You say, oh, there's a buzzing there behind in the background. But it's interesting you say that on the 2-year anniversary of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie getting married, and then now they're splitting up pretty soon. So.
Yeah.
All right. So
if somebody wasn't quite good enough.
Yeah. So we have another question on that same vein, but we're going to actually leave it to the very end. So we're going to continue with the stress management section for today.
Okay.
So today we're going to be going over what the truth is behind stress management. We're going to be going over an article on helpguide.org about tips for getting your stress under control for good. And then we're gonna read what they say, and then we're going to get the commentary from you, Dr. Lau.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Tip number one, identify the sources of stress in your life. For example, do you explain away stress as temporary, even though you can't remember the last time you took a breather? Or is it an integral part of your work or home life? Do you blame your stress on other people or outside events, or is it entirely normal and unexceptional? A stress journal can help you identify the regular stressors in your life.
Wow.
What
a patty cake thing that is. Like, obviously, like, most people don't need a stress journal to figure it out. That's all right. So some pathetic guy's writing an article, and he's a little bit overly structured. But fair enough. Let's continue on and see what else he has to say.
All right. Tip number two, learn healthier ways to cope with stress. So think about ways you currently manage and cope with stress in your life. Like, you can use your stress journal. That can help. Are your coping strategies healthy or unhealthy, helpful or unproductive? Many people cope with stress in the following unhealthy ways. They smoke, they use pills or drugs to relax. There's a lot of interference there on your end, Dr. Lyle. Can you check on that?
Uh-oh. Okay. I don't have no idea what that would be or where it would be from.
That sounded like they were
now?
Shifting around. Yeah, it's much better. It sounded like there was like crumpling of paper or something.
Okay.
All right. unhealthy ways of coping with stress: smoking, drinking too much, sleeping too much, binging on junk food, procrastinating, watching TV for hours on end, and withdrawing from friends, family, and activities, and taking out your stress on others.
Yeah, okay, whatever. Kitchen sink, no insight. Let's continue, see what else he has to say.
Okay. All right. The third tip for managing your stress is get moving. Physical activity plays a key role in reducing and preventing the effects of stress. But you don't have to spend hours in a gym or be some elite athlete. Just about any form of physical activity can help relieve stress and burn away that anger, tension, and frustration.
Yeah, not too bad. All right. There's still hasn't said anything with any intelligence in it. Keep going.
Okay. Tip number four. Connect to others. Social engagement is the quickest, most efficient way to rein in stress and avoid
overreacting. Forget it. We'll just skip over that. That's really stupid.
All right.
Really dumb. Go ahead.
Okay. You're going to love this one. Practice the four A's. The first A is avoid unnecessary stress. The second one is alter the situation. The third one is adapt to the stressor. And four, accept the things you can't change.
All right. How cute is that? I see. So they all begin with A.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's what's wrong with all this is that obviously, as we would expect, there's no high level analysis of understanding of this. So let's get to this. This is kind of like somebody with cardiovascular disease, and we are telling them, well, you know, when your heart hurts, you know, sit down and relax and don't deal with people that are upsetting, you know, because they're going to hurt your heart. Like, nobody's talking about the person's diet as the genesis of this. Okay, so so we are not actually getting to the root of anything here. We're just sort of talking around the symptoms. So let's get down to the core of what stress is, how it works, and a comprehensive, essentially, theory of stress management. And from within that theory, we then have a playbook that can be adapted to any situation and any personality where we have, where we're experiencing a lot of stress. The stress is a response. It's an emotional, psychophysical response to the possibility of loss. That's what stress is. So stress is, you feel stress if you are playing the Super Bowl and you're trying to win because you could lose and it's stressful. You are stressed if you're making a presentation at work and, you know, it could result in a promotion, or you've been on the edge for losing your job, or you're just always worried about your general position, et cetera, and your esteem in the company, or you're showing off for somebody that you're attracted to, or whatever. In other words, the results of this and what people think are of value to you, and there is a variable in outcome that you have judged to be significant, and therefore there is something to lose. You are stressed if you are on the way to the dentist and you are late and they may be upset with you. And so therefore you could lose esteem with the dentist people. So this is we are getting some noise. Is that you or me, or do we know?
I'm okay? Not getting any noise here. Yep.
Okay, you're not getting any noise. Well, now I am. Okay, well, we'll just talk through it. So
okay.
So stress is about, it's the possibility of loss. Stress is, in fact, what's under stress is anxiety. And anxiety is the signal of possible loss. So stress comes when you are uncertain as to whether or not you are going to be able to complete something. So there's a statistical possibility that you will not be able to accomplish it. If I told you that your job was to tie your shoelaces within the next 5 minutes, there would be no stress at all, none, okay? If you had a stroke 2 days ago and you were having a hard time moving your fingers, and I said it's very diagnostic as to whether or not you can tie your shoelaces within 5 minutes right now, and that will tell us a great deal about your future, you would be stressed about this, and as you were working very hard on trying to tie your shoelaces, you would feel stress, okay, because there would be less than 100% possibility that you could pull this off. So stress is about the perceived probability of success. That is what stress is about. When the perceived probability of success is 100%, there is no stress. When the perceived probability of success is zero, there is no stress. It is only between zero and 100 that we have a stress reaction. And we have the amount of stress reaction is directly proportional to your brain's estimate of what the potential loss is with respect to the situation. If it's a loss of your career, a loss of your mate, a loss of your health, then you are very stressed about this, okay? If it is a trivial loss, like you may or may not get get to the 7-Eleven on time to turn in your lotto ticket for $2, then, you know, et cetera. I guess they're 24 hours, but, you know, in principle. Then you're mildly stressed as you try to, you know, get to the window. So this is all, it all depends upon your brain's computation as to how many or to what degree the survival and reproductive genetic chips are on the line. And of course, everything in life is being judged according to their relationship to deep biological values. So your brain is magnificently computing these values, as it also magnificently computes your perceived probability of success of achieving whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to turn out that as you the genesis of a stressful life is the following, that you're designed by nature to always be trying to acquire status, either could be through acquiring resources, so therefore you can show off and waste those resources with fancy house and car and clothes in order to get status. But ultimately, what we are angling for is esteem. And so it's going to turn out that the more we are engaged in interactions with other people, then the more esteem we can get. So think of a social worker who can essentially do her own schedule. And she works at an agency that's pretty slow, and she can actually request from downtown more or less people. So she might request 4 people a day, not too stressful, has an easy job. But depending upon her personality, we could easily have a situation where downtown calls and says, wow, you know, you're just so good and people like you. We've got a little person here that's just got a lot of troubles. Could you see them? And she says yes. And then she's got 5 people. And then they say, oh, gosh, you're just so good. We've got these little triplets. They're all 14 years old, and they're all having such a hard time, and they can't talk to each other very well. Could you see them too? Well, yes. Okay. So now we start finding out that she starts cramming more and more in her day. Now, why is she cramming more and more in her day? Because she likes to get esteem. And so we're all designed by nature to compete with each other in the village for who brings the most to the village. In fact, we're designed by nature to compete to be the most valuable person in the village. If we are the MVP of the village, we are by definition the person in the village for whom the village would give up the most total resources in order to save. So the most valuable person in the village is by definition the safest person in the village. So what people do in order to be safe is they give as much as they possibly can. And so what happens is our little social worker will keep saying yes. Okay? Now, she may not. She may be disagreeable because she's got other people that are more valuable to help, and she tells one person no and tells the other person yes. Okay? So so it's going to turn out that people are all angling for more and more status or esteem in their particular village. And as a result, they are esteemed to the extent that they do more than other people do in this lifetime. So it's going to turn out that the more you do, the more esteem you get, at which point this becomes a competition as to who can be the most efficient at churning out the most esteem-worthy activities. Okay? Now, that being the case, it's going to turn out that people are going to try to be as efficient as possible to cram as much in as they can. So now we're going to take a look at the average housewife. So now we're going to, you know, stereotypically make it that she works part-time. So let's not do that. Let's suppose she works full-time. So she works full-time at a job, and she's quite pleasant and agreeable, and she's got a pushy boss who often needs her to stay after in order to help him, because he's got some things he wants to do, because he wants to be senior vice president next year. And so he needs his people to outwork the competitor's people so that his reports look better and he has accomplished more than his competitor. So he needs to lean on his people in order to churn out more. And our girl does some of that. At the same time, though, she's got 3 kids, and each of those kids, her job is to see to it that those kids are as competitive as possible with respect to their own survival and reproductive ascension. And so they've got soccer practice to go to and everything else under the sun. And they've got violin lessons, et cetera. She's got a husband. She's trying to make sure he sticks around and keeps provisioning the children. So she's under a little bit of stress there. She's supposed to cook dinner. That's her job, okay, et cetera. She's a member of a church where she volunteers some time to the pastor, who, of course, has his own dominance hierarchy, and he's got his own needs to be the fanciest pastor of the Episcopalians in this local hamlet, and therefore he wants to have a better show than the other guy on the other side of town with another, you know, with another church. So he's climbing his own dominance hierarchy because the local deacon is going to be visiting these little shindigs in the next 3 months, and he wants his shindig to be better than the other shindig. And our girl has volunteered. Why? Because he asked for volunteers and passionately described how important this was for the community to have such a wonderful thing. Okay? You see what's happening? Mm-hmm. What's happening is that she keeps saying yes to things in order to gain esteem and to not lose the opportunity to gain more esteem by having to say no. So as she says yes, what happens is she puts more and more into her day. As she puts more and more into her day, we start reducing the perceived probability that she's actually going to be successful at pulling it off. Okay? What can easily be done in 4 hours cannot be done in 2 hours. So now we watch her rushing in the kitchen to get dinner on the table. Okay? Meanwhile, she's watching the clock because one kid needs to get down to a violin lesson, and we're going to have to get it all together here pretty quickly. Okay? And guess what happened to get sacrificed? What gets sacrificed is her own personal goals that don't involve anybody else, like an exercise program or getting to sleep on time. Okay? Those get thrown right out the window. Those are tend to be the first things that get thrown out the window. Any time when you could just sacrifice yourself without pissing off anybody else that you're having to say no to, those would be the very first things that we go. So now we start looking at a life in stress. Okay, so we can talk about what sometimes happens to people. Sometimes people will turn to alcohol, drugs, so forth, but that's really not the main thing, and that is not the, quote, horrible coping mechanisms of our time. The horrible problem of our time is the stress itself. The problem is that the person is overcommitted, okay? You've only got two choices in this life if you're stressed. Almost all stress, incidentally, comes from time pressure. And the time pressure comes from overcommitment, and the overcommitment comes from trying to get too much esteem from too many different people. And those people are not having line of sight on each other, so they cannot see each other. So the pastor cannot see the boss. In the Stone Age, the pastor could see the boss. So the pastor and the boss fought it out, and they argued about where our little girl Nellie is going to be spending the day. Working, okay? But in the modern environment, the village has been fractured. So as a result, the potentates of the village do not have line of sight on each other. And each little potentate, each little king has his own kingdom. And within that kingdom, they do not see the other villages, the other people in our little person's village. And as a result, they don't care about them. They don't think that they're of any worthy merit and shouldn't even be considered, for God's sakes. So as a result, people very often find themselves in the crossfire of different little Napoleons, each of which has their own dominance hierarchy, each of which considers our individual to be part of that team or hierarchy, and therefore they should be sacrificing their lives according to our little Napoleon's view of what would be the most appropriate thing for that person to be doing. And the most appropriate thing for that person to be doing most of the time is to be volunteering some of their time and energy to whatever Napoleon has in mind that's good for Napoleon. So this is the genesis of the world that we see. So the stress that people have has to do with the fact that the Stone Age village is fractured, that people have competing demands from groups where the conflict of interest between those groups is having to be adjudicated by the individual themselves rather than the potentates that would otherwise be fighting it out with each other in the middle of the village square. So as a result of this, our individual now, who is very likely the overwhelming majority of the world, is not alphas. The overwhelming majority of the world is followers. So as a result, the vast majority of people are following, and they are following in multiple hierarchies. As a result of following in multiple hierarchies, they are inevitably in conflict over which hierarchy is going to get most of their time and energy in any given instance. And it's going to turn out that they will sacrifice their own goals, including their own sleep and their own exercise programs, and actually decent diet and the time that it takes to do that. Their own lives will become disordered. Their desk will be a mess, and they will essentially make multiple sacrifices that result in a sense of low-grade chaos. And they will be time-pressured, rushing around, apologizing, and begging off, feeling guilty because on the other side of this, whenever they are late or they fail or they have to essentially get out of a commitment, it's going to turn out that the little potentate is going to be very bent out of shape and put out and essentially upset that they did this to them. So the root of the problem here is going to be conscientiousness and agreeable personalities that make up these unbelievably valuable people in our world. And those people will have a strong tendency to wind up overburdened, stressed out, under way too much time pressure, trying to answer too many multiple demands. And that is our problem. So the solution to the problem, just like heart disease, is to get down to the root of it, not to give some medication on top of it to try to put a little balm on the heart so it doesn't hurt quite as bad. That is not the solution. The solution is to go deep into the process and make sure that we analyze who it is that we need the esteem from, where are our vulnerabilities, and how it is that we are going to reorganize very clearly what our priorities are, and then how we're going to defend ourselves in the teeth of the irritation and downright anger and disappointment and guilt-inducing manipulations of those people who we are going to take our time back from, okay? And so on my website, Esteem Dynamics, I have a lecture there called Success Forces and also a number of little audio clips, and I talk about how we get out of things and one sequence is called Blame Big Louie, and what we do is there are essentially tricks that we use to slither our way around the social pressure that is essentially trying to get us to overcommit and therefore lay the groundwork for our stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what you're saying is we don't need to be, or we may not necessarily need to be part of that many villages.
Yeah, you don't need to have that much status in that many villages. And we don't need to be protecting our status in every village. And if you think about conscientiousness, if you think about the big five that we talked about, personality, individual differences in personality, think about conscientiousness as effectively being it's a measurement of anxiety. And so if a person is very low in conscientiousness, they don't have any anxiety. They don't care if they get to school on time. They don't care if they get to work on time. They don't care if they pay the rent. They don't care if they've taken a shower, okay? They're just basically not very anxious. Whereas think of in your mind's eye of a person that you would call uptight. You know, everything has to be right. Everything's got to be right on target. Every bit of the accounting program needs to work perfectly. Their taxes need to be filed on time. In other words, what's driving them is anxiety. And what this is that what conscientiousness effectively is the analysis of the mind of how much anxiety we should have with respect to a given level of threat. And so an average person has the average amount of anxiety with respect to the average threat. But a highly conscientious person has a high degree of anxiety with respect to the average threat, which means they are miscalibrated, okay? So they are overestimating the worst-case scenario. So they are thinking that they're going to get fired when they're not going to get fired. They are thinking that they're going to get thrown out of the church and scolded or not get into heaven when they're not going to get thrown out of the church and they're not going to heaven anyway. And so essentially what's happening is that they are misallocating their resources. And so they're quite if they're agreeable, they're quite easy to exploit. And so their anxiety and tension and overkill on so many things is actually the result of a nervous system that has unusually positive qualities. In other words, these are very valuable qualities to the village, but they're not particularly valuable qualities to the individual. And so as a result, it's useful for these people, if they're smart enough, to actually back the camera up and understand what is happening here, so that they can do exactly as you're suggesting, which is to make a conscious, deliberate effort to direct their anxiety and conscientiousness towards the people and the villages that matter, and essentially be willing. This is what I call dare to be average. In other words, with respect to a whole lot of the villages that you may be connected to, if you are stressed out a lot, it's because you have not accepted and dealt with and dared yourself to just be average in some of these villages. Just be good enough, okay, rather than shine. This takes a little getting used to, and it also takes a deep analysis of what is really at risk, what villages need to be analyzed carefully, and who are we willing to let go of some status with. And so I actually like to have people monetize some of these risks in order to reduce their anxiety. So, for example, most conflicts of interest between people are about time and energy. And it's going to turn out that what we're squabbling over here is resources. And so what we need to do is we need to find out who is really in control of your resources, who are the most important minds with respect to how it is that you're going to make a living, and how much control do they have, and where are their alternative sources that we may be able to replace them with if need be. And the whole point is here to not be exploited in your life by essentially figuring out who is worth making sure that we are demonstrating excellence to, and who is not worth making sure that we're displaying excellence to. Because if we don't do this, we will wind up with a life out of balance where we've effectively overinsured ourselves by getting too many good grades with too many different people, all for no ultimate benefit to us.
Very interesting. And for people who have individual issues, they're welcome to call into the show here or also visit your website, esteemdynamics.org, to have a private session with you regarding this issue.
Or even better, listen to a bunch of my stuff on there, because the truth is that the techniques are quite they're quite generic. In other words, if you can't adapt them for your situation, no problem. People can always give me a call. But very often, if people will listen to the techniques that I use, like Blame Big Louie, these are techniques for stepping around the social pressure that the potentates will give us. And the potentate might be your mother-in-law, might be your spouse, okay, might be your pastor, might be your boss. I'm not sure who the people are that are putting your life under time pressure, but they're somebody. And we need to think through who they are, why it is that this is happening, and what do we really have to lose if we instead dare to be average.
Yeah, I remember recently I was talking with a family member who had told me that they'd listened to a few of the podcasts, and I asked them to do something, and they said, I wish I could, but I can't. And I thought, oh, dang it, I'm being pushy here. So I backed away right away, and I realized what they were doing.
Yeah, excellent. I'm all happy about this. This is great.
All right.
My little mother, who is a very agreeable and highly conscientious individual, i.e. right to be exploited, was exploited left, right, sideways her whole life. And at about 75, she listened to me give this lecture about 10 years ago. And she sat there and listened to this lecture, and at the end of it,
just got up and said, well, you know, that is great, but I wish I would have known this 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so this these relatively simple techniques for stepping around, this is not changing our personality, and incidentally, this is not assertiveness training. So in the 1960s and 70s, it was recognized by psychologists that this is happening, that a lot of people are getting pushed around and their life goals are going right down the drain and they are stressed out and don't have any time and energy for themselves. And they recognized that what was happening is that their lives are getting overburdened by other people. And so they invented this thing called assertiveness training. And in principle, the idea was great. But in practically speaking, the idea is not good, because essentially the idea is to teach people in such a way that it essentially morphs their personality into being assertive. And I think what they noticed, I know I interrupted you, but I want to share this so that people get it. A lot of nice people, when they get pushed too far, they get aggressive. And they essentially get to a line where they finally display their own anger, because finally the expectations have become so ridiculous on multiple fronts, and they finally go off on somebody who asks 1% too much, and that person doesn't really see that they're that far out of line, but our person finally has had it because they're exhausted and they're end of their rope, and somewhere inside that head, they're realizing that this is not fair, that the whole darn value proposition between them and other people is not fair. And they snap. And by snap, what it means is that their perception of fairness in the situation shifts rapidly to, from them being guilted into thinking that they have not lived up to somebody's expectations and therefore they need to give more, to the inference suddenly that realizes, you know what, I've given too much and I'm exhausted and I've finally had it and I'm not happy. And then they display their anger. And then the problem is that it's not too long before they feel guilty and then they concede more and it's just a mess. So the assertiveness training folks said, hey, listen, you know, there's I forget what it was, passive, aggressive, and assertive. And passive is when you get walked on. Aggressive, you know, then you're being too aggressive. So the thing to be is assertive. And if you read what passes for assertive, it's kind of aggressive and essentially disagreeable. And it's it requires more gonads than most nice people have. They really can't do it. Now, they're nice words for people that are in the middle of the bell curve or more disagreeable than average. So for them, it might give you a few nice lines that you can use. But the truth is the average person is not getting walked on. It's the people in the top 25 percentile for agreeableness who are also conscientious. Those are the people that are getting walked on. And those people cannot absorb the lessons of assertiveness training because it's too much different than their personalities. So they need something else. And that something else is the sleazy set of techniques that I've come up with at my website.
Fantastic. No, these are great. You know, when I first heard that, oh, I wish I could have, but I can't. I right away walked back and thought, geez, maybe I'm being too pushy with this person. It was great.
Yes.
So.
Which I know you, because you undoubtedly were. Okay. All right.
All right.
You had something else looking in your head. You were thinking about.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah. I wanted to know if you can kind of dig into your 30, you know, almost 30 years of clinical experience, and see if there's something you want to share with us about an example about a patient, client that you may like that had this situation and that you had to walk her or him through a stressful situation. And how they got out of it.
I've had so many, I can't even, there's another type of stressful situation instead of doing that I'm going to talk about. This is another common type of problem where we can't, let's suppose somebody is up against a very difficult thing. They have a big exam, okay? They have a big project due. And they agreed 6 months ago they were going to do this big thing, And now it's been looming and they've been putting it off, and now they're pretty overwhelmed. And so this is big time stress. This might be for example, a medical student facing final exams or some such thing, and it's got a huge amount to do, and it can get overwhelming. Now, it turns out that, once again, we see that at the root of almost everything is time pressure. So the person, in order to do what it is that is expected to be done, they can sense that they may not be able to accomplish this in the time that they have. So if it turns out it's some, let's suppose an author has agreed to a book deal and they have to have this book by, you know, November 1st, and the truth is it's only half done, and they're really in trouble. And so they're very stressed, and they feel like just getting drunk and going to Hawaii and not answering their phone. Okay, now, so how do we handle things where we may not be able to measure up to what the expectations are, and yet we are in the chute one way or the other, and we have to do whatever it is? The answer to this kind of stress, which borders on almost a different perspective, which is going to be what I call performance stress as opposed to time pressure. They are very similar. Usually they are interrelated, but they are not always interrelated. So for example, let's suppose we are somebody who's shy, but we've taken a singing class and we've got a recital, you know, 2 weeks from now. Now, we have done everything we've sang and sang and sang, and we know the words, et cetera, but we're feeling very stressed about this. So what is it that we can do about whether it's the medical student or et cetera? We're feeling like we may not be able to accomplish it. The right way to do this is to shift our focus from the outcome to the process. So the outcome for the medical student is to pass. And so that is the goal. Now, I would say let's try to not make that the goal. What we're going to do instead, of course that's our ultimate objective, but what we're going to do is we are going to make something else our goal. And that something else is going to be correctly doing the fundamentals of how it is that we would prepare for this exam. So, for example, we would that medical student, incidentally, and I've had many cases like this, where I found that they're just real smart and people have a lot of confidence, but maybe in a lot of ways they're flying by the seat of their pants, and they have not really ever learned some of the fundamentals of studying. And it might be something else. So you've gone to singing class, but you've never learned the fundamentals of managing anxiety and performance. Okay, so you've been learning how to sing, but you haven't learned those fundamentals. And so what we do is we set up a system where we realize we've got 75 days till some big exam, and we find out essentially how many hours we have to study, and we've got it computed, and then we figure out how much material we've got, and we can figure out pretty quickly that we can only cover 30% of the material. So we decide that's what we're going to do. We can cover 30% of the material. This is the 30% that we're going to do. And we take our notes, and we have little checklists of questions, et cetera, and we methodically work our way through this. And the issue here is that we are going to do this methodically and effectively as possible, and we are going to let the chips fall where they may. And if it turns out that we fail, then we fail. Okay? If it turns out that we succeed, we succeed. If we have to sing at this thing in 2 weeks, we are going to do our little progressive muscle relaxation, jogging in place, stress management process, et cetera. We may, God forbid, if it means enough to you, go to your physician and get a beta blocker so that you can sing for this thing. So we are going to do what is known to do to make that happen. If it turns out that you can't face it, then you can't face it. But we're going to be prepared all the way. If it turns out you choke in the middle of the song, you choke in the middle of the song. Okay? So the notion here is that the goal becomes, goals should fundamentally be that which you have control over. goals are not things that you do not have control over. So a nice way to stress yourself, if you're a young businessman, is to say, well, I'm going to have sales next year of my widget of $1 million. Well, that's kind of ridiculous, okay? And so you go to Tony Robbins and you put it in your mind's eye. You're supposed to think happy thoughts about how this is all going to happen, et cetera. This is
and write post-it notes of $1 million all over your bathroom and your mirror.
Oh, yeah, that's going to work, okay? So, no, the correct way to do things is to get very comfortable with the worst-case scenario. Make sure we know what it is. Almost always, the worst-case scenario is nothing other than inconvenience and embarrassment. That is almost 100% of every worst-case scenario that anybody will ever face. I worked in a maximum security prison where those people, many of those people, had rolled the dice in the justice system because they did not want to take the deal for 8 years, and they lost, and they wound up with a life sentence. That is a very bad outcome, okay? Any outcomes that any of our people face from day to day are unpleasant inconveniences. You may lose your house because your business may go down. You may have to move into your mom's garage until you get a decent job, and you can get an apartment again and start from scratch. These are embarrassments and inconveniences, but these are not terminal cancer, and they are not life sentences. So once we get comfortable with the worst-case scenario and we realize that our job is to not, quote, succeed in the sense of our objective, our job is, in fact, to do the process as intelligently and well as we can. And that includes getting to sleep on time, exercising, and eating healthy food, okay, and taking breaks, and essentially having our lives in some kind of reasonable balance, because that's how we will function best. And this is what we do. And we do it over and again, and we check little boxes every day as we continue to move towards greater ability with respect to whatever this is. And then whatever the outcome is whatever the outcome is. And we'll live with it, okay? And this is how we do stress management from any direction, almost with any problem. That it's useful to make sure that we carefully imagine the worst-case scenario, that we guard against the worst-case scenario as well as effectively as we can, and then we break down the problem, whatever it is, into its fundamentals, and we execute those fundamentals in a methodical fashion. And this is the way we go about doing anything. And if we do it that way, life still has plenty of excitement and there's plenty of drama as to whether or not how successful we're going to be. But we can take some of the unnecessary drama out of it by realizing that these things are not life or death issues. And our job is to do things as reasonably well as we can and let the chips fall where they may.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.